codes confirmed Commodore Braun's worst suspicions. His shell of recon drones had still been racing outward when the first salvos roared in, and only the extreme range and command data link had saved his ships from destruction. His RDs had gotten one good look at the enemy vessels, despite their cloak, before Bremerton fell back to Alpha One. No wonder the initial salvos had been so heavy, and thank God they'd concentrated on his escorting warships. Survey ships were intended to evade enemies, but battlefleet units were designed to survive the crucible of combat, and Bremerton's battlegroup command net fused all the escorts into a single multi-ship entity. Their offensive fire functioned in fine-meshed coordination, and so did their active defenses. The Huns were forced to rely solely on their own onboard point defense, but the escorts were able to bring the anti-missile firepower of every ship in the net to bear on fire directed against any of them. The survey ships had taken heavy damage despite the relatively light fire targeted on them, but his escorts had survived virtually unscathed. Not, he reflected bitterly, that there hadn't been enough rack and ruin to go around this bloody day. The gunslingers had covered the survey ship's retreat, waiting until all the Huns had made transit back into Alpha One before they followed. All Cheltron had been able to do was grit his teeth and take it while he ran, for none of his shipboard weapons could even engage the enemy. His only long-range offensive power was his light carrier's strike groups, but 36 fighters couldn't possibly have taken out 6 SDs, and he dared not linger in missile range of capital ships to recover them anyway. Launching them would have sentenced all their flight crews to death, and so he'd done nothing but run, and he'd never felt so useless in his entire life. TFNS Ute, the last survey ship through, had taken a dreadful pounding before she could transit, but worse was waiting when Cheltwin returned to Alpha One and discovered what had happened to the other survey ships he was protecting. Cheyenne had led the retreat and run straight into the totally unexpected fire of 2 light cruisers. The effects of warp transit had put her defenses far below par, and the cloaked CL's first salvos had come scorching in before she even knew they were there. Their fire had smashed her into an air-streaming hulk and killed 2/3 of her crew, and her sister, Sudanese, had taken almost as many hits before anyone else could assist her. Myrmidon and Tutu had at least managed to find the attackers, and in combination with Callahan, their broadsides had been enough to destroy them, but not before Callahan had been pounded even harder than Sudanese. Now he sat waiting, hands clenched in ivory-knuckled fists, while his comm section worked frantically to sort out the bad news, and the bile of failure burned in his throat. Argive and all her people were gone. If they weren't dead already, they would be soon, and his soul would never forgive him for abandoning her. Now he had 4 more savagely wounded ships, ships he was supposed to protect, and it had been left to the exploration specialists, not their battle fleet escorts, to engage the enemy. He knew it wasn't his fault. Neither he nor Commodore Braun had been given any reason to suspect what was coming, and under the circumstances, the survival of any of SF-27's units was near miraculous. He knew that, and none of it did a thing to reduce his crushing sense of guilt. "Sir?" He looked up as Commander Nauhon appeared beside him. "Cheyenne's a write-off, Skipper," she said. "She's lost all power, can't even blow her fusion plant to scuttle. We think we've gotten everyone off who's still alive, but—" She shrugged helplessly, and Cheltwin nodded in bitter understanding. With the cruiser's power down, dozens of people could be trapped in her ruined compartments, and there was no time for systematic rescue efforts. "Tutu and Ute?" he asked harshly. "Yard jobs, both of them." Nauhon met his gaze unflinchingly, and he saw the echo of his own pain in her brown eyes. "Tutu's lost her ECM, and Callahan's drive damage is even worse than theirs is. None of them can make more than half speed, sir." "Damn," Cheltwin whispered. Then he shook himself. Those SDs had to be coming in pursuit, and he had no time for the luxury of grief. "All right, Isis. Tell Shirak, Sergetov, and Alice to set their scuttling charges and abandon. We'll take them aboard Bremerton and the carriers for now, and redistribute later."
"Commander Sergetov is dead, sir," Nauhon said quietly. "Lieutenant Hashimoto's assumed command."
"Hashimoto?"
Cheltwin stared at her. Arthur Hashimoto was Tutu's assistant engineer, ninth in the chain of command. Dear God in heaven, how heavy had her casualties been?
I don't care who's in command, he snapped, and knew his harsh voice gave him the lie even as he spoke. Just get them aboard.
Yes, sir.
Nohan's reply was carefully expressionless, and he clenched his jaw. Bremerton will stand by Cheyenne. As soon as we've got all the survivors transferred, we'll destroy the wreck by fire.
Yes, sir. Understood.
All right. Cheltwin shoved back in his chair and made himself think. With Argive, Tutu, Cheyenne, and Ute gone, there were only two survey ships left, Myrmidon and Sudanese. They were 30% slower than the escorts, but if the murderous bastards beyond that warp point did indeed mount commercial drives, they were still a third again faster than the pursuing super-dreadnoughts. Adding them to the battlegroup net would slow his warships, but he could still stay away from the enemy if he could get out of range in the first place, and neither of them could hope to survive on their own if they didn't get out of range. Besides, he thought bleakly, with Kersaint detached and Callahan abandoned, he had two nice empty slots to put them in. Get Sudanese and Myrmidon plugged into the net, he said heavily, and Nohan nodded.
Yes, sir.
Cheltwin nodded back, then turned to his tactical officer. What do we know, Fritz? He demanded.
Not much, Skipper, Lieutenant Commander Snow admitted. From the little data I have, it looked like the Commodore was right. They do seem to mount commercial engines, thank God. That's about all I can say with any assurance. I can make a few guesses based on the pattern of the engagement, but guesses are all they'll be.
Call them any damn thing you like, but trot them out fast. Cheltwin's mouth twitched in a bleak parody of a smile, and Snow tugged on an earlobe.
I'd say we got the tech edge, Skip. They were firing in three-ship groups, which probably means they don't have command data link, and that should give us the advantage in any missile engagement, or—
His smile was as bleak as his CO's.
It would if three super dreadnoughts didn't mount more internal launchers than our entire battle group. Understood. Is that the only reason you think we've got better tech?
No, sir. This is more speculative, but sensors confirm they used only standard nukes and first-generation antimatter warheads.
Cheltwin cocked his head with a frown, then nodded.
All right, he said. I think you're onto something there. Anything else?
Not really, sir, and I'm afraid to assume a bigger edge. Just because we develop systems in a given pattern doesn't mean they've done the same thing. Remember the X-ray laser? The Theban's general tech base was well behind ours, but we'd never even thought of that one. These people may have surprises of their own.
Point taken, Cheltwin grunted, and turned his head as Nohan reappeared.
We've gotten everyone we could find off Cheyenne, sir, and Myrmidon and Sudanese are tied into the net. We should have the last personnel off Callahan, Tutu, and Ute in another 10 minutes. The small craft are docking with them now.
Then get us underway. The boats are fast enough to overtake us, and I want as much distance as possible between us and this warp point before the bad guys come through.
Aye, aye, sir.
Nohan nodded to Bremerton's astrogator, and the tattered survivors of Survey Flotilla 27 and its escorts began to move.
Do you have a lock on Cheyenne, Fritz?
Aye, Skipper.
Snow sounded unhappy, and Cheltwin didn't blame him. No one liked to destroy one of his own, but they couldn't let that Hulk's data or technology fall into enemy hands.
Destroy her, he said harshly,
and the TAC officer pressed the firing key. There was no drive field to interdict, and the survey cruiser's shattered wreck vanished in a sunbright boil as a single warhead took her dead amidships. Cheltwin watched the visual display as Cheyenne died, and his bitter eyes matched the hellish glare of her pyre. Then he made himself look away as Nohan finished passing his orders to the small craft evacuating the other three ships. He beckoned to her and rose from his own chair to glower into the main plot.
We'll try to run without engaging them, Isis. Fritz thinks we've got a tech advantage, but it's not enough to let us go toe-to-toe with capital ships.
Yes, sir.
Have Mangadulaga rearm his birds. Shipping strikes against that much firepower would be suicide, and we'll need them for a combat space patrol if they bring up carriers of their own.
Yes, sir. Should we launch Shah's group now? They're already configured for intercepts.
Cheltwin shook his head. No. We should have enough warning to get the CSP off from standby before anyone can hit us, and I want maximum endurance on their life support when we do launch.
Understood, sir.
All right. Once you've passed those instructions, get a fresh RD shell deployed. We don't have enough of them, so use them to sweep a 60-degree cone along our line of advance. We'll just have to take our chances on the flanks.
We could cover that with the recon fighters,
Nahan began, then shook her head.
No, we'll need every bird we've got for self-defense.
Exactly, Cheltwin agreed. Besides, he gave another bleak smile, I want to keep the fact that we've got them our little secret for as long as possible. It's unlikely these people don't have fighters of their own, but if they think we don't, they may come in fat and happy, and we need every edge we can get.
Yes, sir.
As soon as we've gotten all that done, the captain went on, run everything we got from Commodore Braun's drone, and every sensor reading, tactical, and plotting got on the actual engagement through the computers. Add Callahan's download from what happened here and put battle comp on it. See if they can improve on Fritz's guesstimate of their capabilities. Then download the results and all the raw data to 2 courier drones. Send one to Kersaint so Hausman knows what's going on, and send the other straight to Sarasota.
Yes, sir.
Nahan gazed into the plot for a moment, then raised her eyes to her COs.
What does Sarasota have available, sir?
She asked softly, and Cheltwin sighed.
Not enough, he admitted in an even lower voice. Admiral Villiers is on maneuvers in K-45, but he's only got a light task group. The next closest force is Admiral Murakuma's, and she's clear up beyond Romulus.
She'll need time to get here, and her heaviest unit's a battleship. He turned to face his exec squarely.
These people have one hell of an industrial base just in this one system. If they come after us, we're going to lose a lot of systems before we can get enough fleet units in here to stop them, Isis.
Nahan opened her mouth, then closed it, nodded, and walked towards the comm section. Cheltwin watched her go, and his thoughts were grimmer even than his face, for he knew what she hadn't said. There were only 5,000 colonists in the Golan system, but there were 8 million in Meriwether, another 30 million in Justin, over 100 million in Sarasota, and more than 1 billion in the 5 inhabited systems of the Remus Cluster. And Alex Cheltwin and the Terran Federation Navy were oath-bound to protect them all. He knew that. It was the highest calling he could imagine. The reason he'd first put on Navy black and silver and sworn himself to the Federation's service. And he knew the men and women of the fleet would honor that oath or die trying. But he also knew that unless the TFN had one hell of a technological advantage, this time it was a promise they couldn't keep.
Chapter 3 The Stuff of Dreams.
No one had ever really been able to account for the existence of warp points, least of all the humans who'd blundered onto the one in Sol's outer system by accident. Centuries ago, the great Orion astrophysicist Fimano Hausril predicted the presence of Kanai's warp points, but only by inference from their effect on that system's bodies. His work begged the question of causation. Everyone agreed they must in some way be related to the still imperfectly understood phenomenon of gravity, which shapes space. That much was clear from the grav surge that made them directly detectable. So the most popular theory held they must result from interruptions in a galactically vast pattern of gravitational interrelationships. Fortunately for this theory, most warp points occurred in association with the gravity wells of stars. Unfortunately for it, some didn't. Starless warp nexi were as depressing for starfarers as they were frustrating for theorists. For it was only here that humans, or members of any other known species for that matter, ever experienced the reality of the interstellar abysses they normally bypassed. Here, with no nearby sun to give a reference point, finite minds must confront infinity, and the bottomless void could swallow the soul of anyone who stared into it too long. Rear Admiral Anthony Villiers knew the void well, for he'd spent a goodly percentage of his life in space. He knew it was just as well that most of TF-58's personnel never needed to look beyond the bulkheads of their ships. The terror that could overtake even strong minds, the sensation of lostness, of awakening from a dream of cozy ordinariness into a horrifyingly incomprehensible reality, was a problem that had been outweighed in the TFN's estimation by the security advantages of conducting maneuvers in a starless nexus like K-45. Villiers wasn't altogether convinced. But now he stood, ramrod straight as usual, and stared into the flag bridge's viewscreen. None of the task force's other ships were visible, of course, even if they'd been close enough. What light was there for them to reflect? There was only an emptiness that mirrored what he felt inside as he listened to his chief of staff announce the unthinkable. "And so Comm was able to finish copying the message before the last of the drones transited to Justin," Captain Santos reported, plowing doggedly ahead despite the Admiral's lack of response. Could nothing take the starch out of that stiffness? "Captain Sheltwin concludes his report to HQ by stating he'll soon be transiting to Indra, but doesn't intend to halt there. He'll proceed directly to Golan and assume a defensive posture. He requests that all available reinforcements..." "Quiet," Villiers cut in abruptly, turning on his heel to face Santos. "We will discontinue the maneuvers forthwith. All elements of the task force will proceed immediately to Golan at maximum speed, Commodore." In some segments of the TFN, the shipboard courtesy promotion of anyone holding the rank of captain, reserving the sacrosanct title for the skipper, was considered passé. Villiers upheld it with the same rigor he brought to the enforcement of the most traditional possible interpretation of uniform regulations. This surprised no one, least of all his staff, who now stood uncomfortably under the gaze of those pale blue eyes. "But, Admiral," Santos said hesitantly, "we've received no orders to—" "We scarcely need them, Commodore," Villiers clipped in that version of standard English, which, coming from that little island of Old Terra which had birthed the language, held a certain prestige-conferring rightness everyone else in the Federation recognized, even as they resented it. "As the nearest force, we are not only authorized but required to respond to Captain Cheltwin's request for reinforcements. Standing Order 347A admits of no ambiguity in this matter." Santos's brown face remained impassive, but Commander Frankel, the operations officer, hadn't been with Villiers long. He turned his head a few degrees toward Commander Takeda, the supply officer, and muttered, "Oh yeah, the Orglon scenario." The lips under Villiers' micrometrically trimmed mustache thinned even more than was their wont, and he gave Frankel a glare beneath which the ops officer wilted. "I believe, Commander, that we can all identify the standing order in question without recourse to sensationalistic labels which the popular media have dredged up from cheap science fiction." Everyone tried to be as inconspicuous as possible, for Frankel had disturbed a particularly rampant bee in Villiers' bonnet. The real problem, of course, was that the cheap science fiction had been produced by a fellow TFN officer. Not that Villiers would have willingly accorded Captain Marcus LeBlanc any such status. The maverick intelligence officer would have been anathema to Villiers even had he not used his spare time to write a novel almost as notable for its iconoclasm about the upper fleet echelons as for its heterodoxy concerning potential alien threats. Still, LeBlanc's Orglon Empire had filled what seemed to be a widespread need after two generations of peace. Plausible menaces were hard to come by these days. Santos came to Frankel's rescue by changing the subject. "You said maximum speed, sir. Did you mean that literally?" "What, pray tell, might lead you to suspect I did not?" Villiers asked in a deceptively mild tone. "But, sir, if we run the drives flat out over that long a period, we're likely—" "I am quite aware of the implications, Commodore." Villiers' cold gaze swept over the staff before he resumed in fractionally less glacial tones. "If there is any truth to Captain Cheltwin's report, and I cannot believe he would be guilty of hysterical exaggeration, the urgency of this matter cannot be overstated. Both time and firepower of the essence, and the task force will proceed at maximum. See to it, Commodore." Without another word, he turned away from the array of eyes with their varying degrees of resentment and gave his attention to the tactical display. Presently, the little colored dots that represented 3 battleships, 7 battle cruisers, 4 light carriers, 3 heavy cruisers, two light cruisers and three destroyers, began to curve around into courses that would take them to the warp point leading to Erebor and thence to Golan. He stole a glance at the viewscreen, where the stars were precessing as TFNS Rattlesnake altered heading. It sometimes occurred to Villiers to imagine how one of the pioneering astronauts of 4 centuries ago would have reacted to the sight of spacecraft performing this kind of maneuver. Depending on temperament, the astronaut would probably have sought out either psychiatric counseling or the nearest bar. For in those days, reaction drives had been, and the physics of the day had confidently asserted would always be, the only way to get around in space. Today's reactionless drives slipped through a then unsuspected loophole in the law of conservation of momentum, though they didn't really cancel inertia. Rather, a modern ship wrapped itself in a drive field, which could best be described as an inertial sump, though the term caused the specialists to wince. Thus it had become possible to cheat Newton even before the discovery of warp points had made it possible to cheat Einstein. But like anything else, the drives could go wrong. Villiers glanced back at the TAC display and noted the tight formation as the task force accelerated to the maximum 25,000 kps its battleships could maintain. Of course, how long it could continue to move at 8% of light speed was anyone's guess. Military engines allowed a higher tactical speed than any commercial engine could produce. The maximum speed of a battleship or SD with a commercial drive would be almost 10,000 kps slower. But their higher power levels made them more failure-prone. Running them at such high output for the entire voyage to Golan could have catastrophic effects, however good his engineers, and he knew it as well as Santos. Yet he'd spoken no more than the truth to the captain, indeed, rather less than the truth. His command was too weak to defeat the forces Cheltwin had reported in a deep space battle. His only real chance was to fight delaying actions until help reached him, and he could not afford to give up a single warp point without a fight. He could only hope the mysterious unknowns, the Orglons, some annoying imp whispered at the back of his mind, would continue surveying Indra until he reached Golan, and even at these ruinous power levels, the odds that he would arrive in time were low. None of which mattered in the least as far as his responsibilities were concerned. For now, he wouldn't let himself think about it, or about the civilians at the Golan outpost, more civilians than he could possibly evacuate, even if he packed them in like the cargo of some ancient slave ship. He stood at the notoriously misnamed position of parade rest, gazing into the viewscreen and thinking thoughts that none of the men and women on the flag bridge would have guessed. For he was thinking of the 60 years that had passed since the Theban War, and wondering if anyone ever recognized a golden age before it was over.
"Excuse me, Admiral."
Villiers looked up from the paperwork on his terminal as Captain Santos entered his briefing room.
"Yes?" "I've just received a message from Naganita, sir. Commander Plevetskaya's engineers have reported a serious harmonic in her number 2 drive room."
"How serious?"
"Bad enough they had to shut it down, sir. Plevetskaya's got enough reserve speed to hold station for the moment, but her people report signs of collateral damage in Drive 1. She's requested time to conduct diagnostics, but she needs to shut down Drive 1 to do it, so, with your permission, I'll instruct the task force to slow to let her..."
"Out of the question, Commodore. I will depart from my usual practice and repeat myself. All elements of the task force are to proceed at maximum speed for Golan."
Santos opened his mouth, then closed it with a click, nodded sharply, and withdrew.
The hatch hissed shut behind him, and Villiers gazed at it for a long, silent second. Task Force 58 was barely halfway to Erebor, and he would be fortunate indeed if Naganita was the only ship which had to drop out of formation. Yet he dared not slow. It was a cruel trade-off. If he maintained speed, he lost ships he might need desperately. But if he slowed down, he lost something even more precious. Time. Perhaps that's why these buggers put commercial drives into their warships in the first place, he thought. No Terran designer would accept such a tactical inferiority. But look at the strategic advantage it gives them. Their super dreadnoughts can actually move 50% faster than ours over any sort of long voyage. He gazed at the hatch for another endless moment, then sighed. Well, I can't change what I have, and I suspect I shall be happy enough to have it once the shooting starts.
He snorted a mirthless chuckle and returned his attention to his terminal. As soon as possible after the task force's arrival in the Golan system, Villiers had the man he was relieving piped aboard Rattlesnake. Ordinarily, Captain Cheltwyn knew, his haggardness would have drawn at least an unspoken rebuke from the Admiral, whose standards of punctilio sometimes provoked muttered speculations about time travelers from the Victorian era. But Villiers greeted him with his very best attempt at warmth, not that it really mattered to Alex Cheltwyn at that moment. He'd seen most of his command die, and then waited in this system, praying that reinforcements arrived before the attack that would obliterate his 3 effective ships with contemptuous ease. He could still function, but he would never again be young. Now he sat facing Villiers and his staff in Rattlesnake's outrageously spacious, or so it seemed to a man accustomed to ships of heavy cruiser size or smaller, briefing room. The staffer's eyes told him they'd hoped for some sort of reprieve from him, some silver lining to the pall his courier drones had cast over their universe, and he felt an altogether irrational guilt because he had none to give. His eyes sought the briefing room's viewscreen. Nothing could be seen save the star-blazing firmament. Golan B, this system's Class M secondary sun, lurked 250 light-minutes away with its sterile brood of planets, not even visible as a ruby star. Golan A, the system primary, would have gleamed with a soul-like yellow light calculated to awake memories imprinted in Cheltwyn's genes, but it was in the wrong direction. So for lack of an alternative, his eyes wandered back to the troubled faces around the table. Villiers, however, remained unruffled. Cheltwyn had never met the Admiral, but so far he'd seen nothing to contradict his reputation as a man who would never enjoy widespread affection, but who had a certain martinet style. "Now then, ladies and gentlemen," the Admiral rapped, reasserting control of a meeting that had threatened to drift into despondent aimlessness. "First things first. Commodore Santos, have the pinnaces completed transit to Indra?"
"They have, sir."
"Excellent." It had been one of Villiers' first priorities on arrival. Cheltwyn could fully understand why, after having waited in this system while an enemy of unknown but certainly overwhelming strength prowled on the far side of a warp point. He'd had to live with it. None of his surviving ships could be left behind in Indra, and none of them carried warp-capable pinnaces. Villiers' capital ships did, and he'd dispatched 3 of them at once. They would lurk in the outer reaches of the Indra system, probing stealthily inward toward the fire of Indra's sun to observe the enigmatic foe. They didn't carry courier drones, of course. They were little bigger than courier drones themselves, but they would always leave at least one of their number near the warp point, poised to dash through with word of any onrushing attack. It was, Cheltwyn reflected, a classic problem. He who would defend a warp point knew exactly where his opponent must come from, but he normally could not know when the attack would come, and, contrary to the assumptions of journalists and politicians, no military organization can remain permanently at maximum alert. But Villiers' opponents hadn't yet settled into Indra, and, indeed, probably hadn't yet surveyed the warp point that led to Golan, a fact he meant to exploit for all it was worth. He might face overwhelming numbers, but he would not be taken by surprise. "Excellent," the Admiral repeated, absently tapping the edge of the table with a light pencil that he contrived to wield like an ivory and gold baton. "Now, as to our deployment, I know of nothing to invalidate the tactical conclusions which we reached en route, and of which I believe Commodore Cheltwyn has been apprised." He lifted one inquisitory eyebrow, and Cheltwyn nodded in confirmation. "Well, then, it's clear enough that a light battle line such as ours can't hope to go toe-to-toe, as it were, with an opponent who can bring to bear the kind of tonnage Commodore Cheltwyn observed, especially in light of our lack of antimatter ordnance." And, Frankel muttered, in tones just low enough to be arguably short of insubordination, "in light of the fact that we haven't got Naginata." Cheltwyn sucked in a breath and braced himself for an explosion. But none occurred, and he came to the realization that he was the only one who was shocked. Clearly, the ops officer had tapped into a deep pool of resentment. Even Santos's glare at his immediate subordinate seemed motivated more by outrage at violated proprieties than by any fundamental disagreement. Villiers didn't allow the silence to stretch.
"Commander Plevatskaya has personally assured me that she anticipates no great delay in solving her engineering problem since being left behind," he said mildly. "So Naginata should be rejoining us in short order. In the meantime, we will follow our pre-planned operational dispositions. Our carrier group, including Shah and San Jacinto," he inclined his head in Cheltwin's direction, "will deploy so as to be able to cover the warp point. Our battle line will hold back and offer long-range missile support." He turned toward Cheltwin again. "Our fighter should come as an unpleasant surprise to an opponent who apparently lacks any knowledge of them, and still lacks it, thanks to Commodore Cheltwin's courageous act in forbearing to reveal his fighter capability." Cheltwin felt a glow of satisfaction at praise from a man to whom praise clearly did not come naturally. "At the same time," Villiers continued, "this deployment will also minimize the enemy's opportunity to use boarding tactics like those of the Thebans. Admittedly, none of Commodore Cheltwin's observations suggest that they employ any such tactics. Nevertheless, we want no surprises along these lines. We are ill-equipped to face boarders in the absence of our Marines."
Heads nodded around the table. After transiting from Erebor to this system, Villiers had first proceeded to Golan A-2, a life-bearing planet, but no great prize from the standpoint of human habitability, and landed all his ship's marine detachments there before proceeding on to rendezvous with Cheltwin's survivors. The publicly announced reason had been to help the outpost's administration maintain order in event of panic. The real reason was known to everyone in the briefing room, but Villiers' next words brought it home to them anew, and Cheltwin felt his depression come flooding back.
"This leads us to the matter of contingency planning for the evacuation of Golan A-2, the Admiral stated inexorably. "The chief engineer has prepared an estimate of how many civilians we can accommodate with the marine berthing spaces freed up and by going to emergency life support procedures. It is, of course, nothing like the outpost's entire population, but on a positive note, it is a figure which we can realistically hope to embark in a short period of time, especially given the fact that the Marines are already planet-side and won't have to be debarked simultaneously."
Villiers paused reflectively, evidencing no reaction to or even awareness of the seeming drop in the briefing room's temperature. Then he resumed with his customary briskness.
"The problem, of course, is one of choosing which civilians can be evacuated and which will remain. After studying the chief engineer's report and the local demographic data, I have decided that first priority will be given to children of age 12 and under, and second priority to pregnant women. We should be able, barely, to accommodate all members of these two categories."
Santos spoke impassively, breaking the silence.
"One possible problem, Admiral. The separation of the members of these categories from their families may cause difficulties. It could result in disruptions which we can ill afford, since any such evacuation will, by its nature, be subject to a tight schedule. If," he added almost defiantly, "it takes place at all."
"A valid concern, Commodore. Before his disembarkation at Golan A-2, I spoke privately to Major Kemal. He is fully aware of such potential problems, and is prepared to take whatever measures are necessary to assure the successful evacuation of those we are able to evacuate. He," Villiers continued, laying a slight stress on the pronoun, "is under no illusions as to our inability to save all the civilian population here, nor as to our duty to save those we can." He ran his cold eyes around the table, forcing each of them to meet his gaze. And some of them thought of that which he left unsaid, the fact that if they were forced out of Golan, they'd be in the same position all over again in Erebor, except that this system held 5,000 civilians, and that one held over 50...
The chime of his bedside communicator and the whooping of klaxons through the structure of the ship awakened Villiers. He tried to speak, but had to swallow before he could address the machine.
"Yes."
"Admiral," came the voice of Rattlesnake's captain, "the pinnaces have transited back from Indra, broadcasting the alert. As per your standing orders, I've sounded general quarters."
"Quite right, Captain. I'll be on the flag bridge directly." Odd, he thought, as he swung out of his bunk. He should have been fighting a black tide of despair, because he'd awakened into his ultimate nightmare. The attack had come before any reinforcements had reached him. But he found he preferred that nightmare, even though there was no awakening from it, to the one from which the communicator had roused him, the one in which all the dying women and children had worn the faces of his wife and daughter. Chapter 4. What else would you have me do? Explosions and all other manifestations of violence, however cataclysmic, produce no noise in the vacuum of space. So there was nothing incongruous or eerie about the silence in which the events at the warp point linking Golan with Indra were transpiring. What was eerie was the silence on Rattlesnake's flag bridge, where Anthony Villiers and his staff stood with shock-marbled faces and watched Ragnarok unfold. The returning pinnaces had warned them of what to expect, but those dryly factual reports hadn't prepared them for the reality of a dozen mountainous super-dreadnoughts emerging one after another from the warp point, intruding their brutal masses into the metrical frame of local space-time like malignant tumors. Nevertheless, there had been enough warning for the six carriers, positioned to cover the warp point, to launch their full complements of fighters before the first of the mysterious hostiles materialized. And the invaders' vectors were randomized, as was inevitable on emergence from an unsurveyed warp point, so it was under optimum conditions that the fighters, laden with external FR-1 close-attack missiles, swooped down on those mammoth ships out of hell. Sending them in against such odds with weapons as short-ranged as the FR-1 had been a grim decision. Yet there was little choice. The longer-ranged FM-2 would have allowed them to attack from beyond the effective close-in envelope of most anti-fighter weapons, but an entire squadron could mount only 12 FM-2s, and that throw weight was too little to saturate a super-dreadnought's point defense. One or two would probably get through, but even if TF-58 had antimatter warheads, the FM-2 couldn't mount one. They needed the greater damage the heavy warhead of an FR-1 could deliver, and the close-attack weapon moved at such high velocities as to be impossible for point defense to intercept. Villiers' pilots would pay a high price to get into range in the first place, but once they did, they would also inflict far, far greater damage. Fortunately, it soon became apparent that Cheltwin, now aboard Ska commanding the carriers, was right. No opponent with experience of fighters would have made so little effort to avoid letting those tiny little craft slip into the blind zones that Starship's space-distorting, reactionless drives created directly aft of themselves. A conclusion reinforced by the ineffectual quality of the enemy's point-defense fire. So almost all of the carrier's 108 fighters survived to send their FR-1s racing ahead, overloaded little drives piling acceleration atop the fighter's own vectors and suicide-compelled cybernetic brains seeking self-immolation. It took seconds for the light of the explosions to reach Villiers' battle line, hanging back at extreme missile range. The people on the flag bridge watched, faces bathed in the glare of nuclear warheads and the strings of secondary explosions that erupted as shields went down and bare metal sundered. They watched in silence as the readouts told a tale of devastation beyond their peacetime-conditioned imaginations, all of them but one. For Villiers, though appalled as any, forced himself to analyze the readouts beyond the raw totals of vaporized tonnage. "Commodore Santos," he said after a moment. The chief of staff started, for the clipped voice had been almost like a gunshot in the hush. "If you will note, certain patterns appear to be emerging in the data." "Patterns, sir?" Santos moved to join the admiral while the others looked on. "You mean the enemy's apparent unfamiliarity with fighters?"
"Yes, Commodore Cheltwin certainly stands confirmed on that point. But I'm thinking now of the response to our own missile fire."
The battleships and battlecruisers had been supporting the fighters with missile fire, not very effective at this range. Or rather, the lack of any such response after the initial release of their external ordnance. This, combined with the volume of energy weapon fire the fighters have reported, ineffectual fire, unsurprisingly, given that ship-to-ship weapons aren't intended for an anti-fighter role, point to only one conclusion."
"You mean, sir, precisely.
Those super-dreadnoughts are pure energy weapon platforms, with no integral missile armament. So the enemy's possession of antimatter warheads is at present, academic. Villiers' sharply chiseled features wore an annoyed expression.
Pity. We could have positioned ourselves at a far more effective missile range from the warp point. But that's water over the dam, isn't it? At present, the fighters are retiring to rearm, and the enemy is still coming. We must engage them more closely at once. Captain Kruger, he spoke in the direction of a comm pickup, addressing rattlesnakes, Captain. A series of orders was passed, and the battle line began to advance.
Sir, Santos spoke up, super-dreadnought-sized enemy units are still emerging from the warp point. Some of them, in the later waves, are bound to mount missile launchers, and they do have antimatter warheads.
True enough, Commodore, but I call your attention to another pattern in the data. Please note these recurring figures and the fighters' reports of the volume of fire they encountered.
Santos studied the columns of figures, while others, including Frankel, peered over his shoulders. Slowly, the Chief of Staff's frown smoothed itself out into understanding.
Admiral, unless I'm misreading the data, those—
He caught himself before using a colorfully obscene term.
Hostiles really don't have command data link.
Exactly so, Commodore. Commodore Chiltwin would appear to have been correct about that as well. And given that advantage in fire control technology, I am prepared to risk a missile duel with an antimatter armed opponent, even without Naginata.
The battlecruiser had limped into Golan only 4 hours before the attack had begun, and was still toiling across the system at a speed not even Commander Plevitskaya's frantic determination could improve.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, I suggest that we let Captain Kruger fight her ship and concentrate on trying to discern further clues as to the enemy's capabilities and intentions.
Santos's "Aye, aye, sir," was echoed by a rumble of agreement from the staff, including an unexpectedly emphatic contribution from Frankel. Villiers' battle line, so puny in tonnage compared to the procession of enemy SDs that continued to emerge into Golan space, closed to effective missile range, and the space-racking release of energies escalated to a level that space itself seemed insufficient to contain. It soon became apparent the enemy's fire control was indeed a generation behind the TFNs. Only half as many of those dark ships could link into a single entity for targeting purposes. Perhaps even more importantly, that applied to defensive fire as well as missile salvos, for after the first dozen super-dreadnoughts had come others that did mount missile launchers, in the numbers possible only to hulls of such size, and they did have antimatter warheads for those missiles. But only occasionally could such a missile get through the lattice of defensive lasers from as many as 6 Terran ships. The few that did were enough to savage the battleships Aegle and Culloden, and obliterate the heavy cruiser Emmanuel Filberto and the destroyers Lancer and Suleiman. Nothing less than a capital ship could withstand more than a very few hits from the fires of antimatter annihilation. But time and again, 6 of Villiers' ships sent the entire output of their launchers to converge on a single target, as though actuated by a single will. Their warheads, though limited to essentially the same merely nuclear energies that had seared Hiroshima and Bombay so long ago, would ignite simultaneously in a cluster of fireballs that grew, touched, and blended together in a single glare of destruction that revealed an expanding cloud of gas and glowing debris when it faded. And Villiers, maintaining a mask of cold aloofness amid the whoops and shouts of triumph on the flag bridge, allowed himself for the barest instant to hope. But still those ships came. There were no more super-dreadnoughts after the 24th of those Brobdignagian vessels had emerged, to their deaths in 9 cases, but battlecruisers followed, one after another, with nightmarish repetition, and they were armed with missiles, full magazines of missiles. Villiers studied the dwindling totals of his own ship's depletable munitions with a concentration broken only by the report that the destroyer Danton had died. That brief, cruel moment of near euphoria that had slipped past his defenses only made it worse. The Admiral drew himself up, armored in formality, and turned to Santos.
Commodore, it is now time to implement our contingency plan for evacuating this system. Have comm raise Commodore Chiltwin for me.
The Chief of Staff, his brown face speaking silently for all of them, gave an order. Villiers looked into the face of Alex Chiltwin and passed it at the tightly controlled excitement on Shah's bridge as the light carrier prepared to send her rearmed fighters back into the struggle.
"Commodore Chiltern," he began without preamble, "it has become necessary for us to break off engagement. Our speed advantage should enable us to reach Golan A-2 before the enemy. But if he presses the pursuit, he will arrive there in time to prevent completion of our evacuation plan. It is therefore imperative that the fighters cover our withdrawal, delaying the enemy's advance. Can you do it?"
"We'll try, sir."
"Remember, your carriers are too valuable to be risked within missile range of the enemy. You're to avoid letting them close to you, while harrying them with fighter strikes."
"Understood, Admiral. We'll do our best."
"I'm sure you will, Commodore. You know, of course, that much depends on it."
Villiers made no direct mention of the civilians on Golan A-2, nor did he need to. The battlecruisers slid through space, pulling ahead of the ponderous super-dreadnoughts, but not as far ahead as they might have, for the inexplicable little attack craft persisted in their stinging, irritating attacks, which had to be dealt with. The seemingly impossible performance data of their tormentors was not really a matter of interest, except on the level of tactical utility. Analysis would, of course, be left to higher authority. And aside from minor tactical adjustments, no deviation from course was thinkable, for the main enemy force had broken off, fleeing towards the electroneutrino spore which betrayed a habitable world. Those battleships must not be allowed to escape, and if they were foolish enough to stand in defense of that world, so much the better. At the outpost's longitude, Golan A was setting in a red glow, all too suggestive of blood.
"No, Lidochka!"
Ludmila Igorevna Borisovna strained between the arms of two marines and cried out to her daughter. 2-year-old Lydia Sergeyevna, blonde hair whipping in the wind around a face congested with terror, screamed back as she was borne away across the space field, and Ludmila struggled harder, heedless of her husband's efforts to restrain her. Then a shadow fell across them, and from the height afforded by a powered combat armor, a face looked down, a swarthy face with a hawk-like nose and slitted dark eyes. The tribes of humanity had been united under the Federation since the days before they had ventured off old Terra into interstellar space, and ethnic distinctions meant nothing anymore, of course. And yet, too many times, men with faces like that had ridden out of the steppes, looking on the Slavic tillers of the soil simply as another herd to be thinned. But this man wore the insignia of a major of TFN Marines, and he looked down at them with a compassion that shone through his sternness.
"I'm sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Borisov,"
Major Mohammed Kemal said,
"but the Admiral's orders are clear. Children and pregnant women take priority. I must insist that you cooperate."
"Chernozopi!"
Ludmila spat. Kemal blinked in incomprehension of the word, literally black ass, that the Russians had used for his sort of people from time immemorial. She was about to say more, but a hand grasped her shoulder from behind as Irma Sanchez, maneuvering her swollen belly through the crowd, moved up from her place next in line.
"Let them take her, Ludmila," she said urgently. "She'll be safe. I'll look after her, I promise. And you'll rejoin her. You heard the Major's announcement earlier. The Navy will pick up everyone else before they leave this system. They have to, don't they, Major?"
"Of course, ma'am," Kemal said emphatically.
"You hear that, Mila?"
Sergei Ilyich Borisov tried his clumsy best to be soothing.
"Everything will be all right. You'll see. Now let's go."
Ludmila stared fixedly ahead, but the blonde head had vanished in the crowd just as the screams had been swallowed tracelessly by the general din, and she was denied a final look.
"Lidoshka,"
she whispered before letting her husband lead her away.
"Thank you, ma'am,"
Kemal said quietly.
"Don't thank me, you motherless bastard,"
Irma Sanchez spoke dispassionately.
"I did it for them, not to make it easier for you to carry out your goddamned orders. And the fact that those orders are right doesn't make you any less a liar."
Head aloft, she marched out across the field towards the waiting shuttle without a backwards look. Kemal stared after her, and everything that went into his makeup prevented him from shouting after her, as he wished to.
"What else would you have me do?"
The last of the light carriers sailed out of the warp point into the sky of Erebor, and Anthony Villiers allowed himself an inaudible sigh of relief.
Less than a third of the fighters those ships had once carried were still aboard them. The others remained in the Golan system, either as impalpable clouds of infra-debris or as derelict hulks, now lifeless or soon to be, that had been beyond the hope of recovery as the task force fled Golan. But all six of the carriers had survived, and they'd done their job of delaying the enemy's advance. Villiers couldn't actually hear the weeping and moaning of the children and pregnant women crowded into Rattlesnake's bowels, but he imagined he could. It had been a near thing. The mysterious foe had come inexorably on, slowing to fight off their attackers, but never allowing themselves to be swayed from their course, as though held by some wizard's geas to advance by the most direct route toward the nearest concentration of human life. Villiers had almost stopped trying to imagine what manner of beings crewed those silent engines of destruction, and he'd ceased reprimanding people who'd use the word Orglons, for he had no better theory to offer. Captain Marcus LeBlanc, wearing his novelist's hat, had tapped into a nightmare which had receded nearly to the vanishing point in the years of peace. He'd conjured the ultimate enemy, an alien empire that had been expanding for millennia through one warp point after another, growing like a melanoma in the body of the galaxy. His Orglons represented the obscene end product of the unrestricted cyborging on which humankind had turned its back after some bad experiences in the 21st century. Flesh and metal, neurons and silicon blended into a soulless amalgam created long ago by a race that no longer knew or cared what its own original organic form might have been. If indeed that race could still be said to exist at all, after having merged its identity into that of its machines. Villiers had scoffed, but now, with the memory of those relentless attackers fresh in his mind, he wasn't so sure. On impulse, he turned to the intelligence officer.
"Commander Santorelli, you know Marcus LeBlanc, don't you?"
Lieutenant Commander Francesca Santorelli looked up from her terminal, surprised.
"Why, yes, Admiral, I met him on my first deployment. He was Chief Intelligence Officer aboard—"
"Well, Commander," Villiers went on, as though he'd barely heard her,
"when you're preparing your summaries for the courier drones, I suggest you keep him and the sorts of things he'd want to know in mind. You see, I have a feeling he's going to be called in on this."
He turned away to face the tactical display and watched his task force, with its empty missile magazines and its two-thirds empty fighter bays and its refugee-crammed berthing spaces, deploy to meet the possibility he tried not to let himself think about. An immediate enemy advanced through the warp point whose location they must know about, since they'd been within scanner range to observe his ships vanishing into it. No, he couldn't think about that just now, nor about the 53,000 colonists on Erebor A-2. For if those silent ships emerged from conquered Golan, laden with death, he'd have precisely one option— immediate withdrawal, without even thinking about trying to evacuate the colonists. "Well," Commodore Augustino Reichman breathed as the disorientation of transit subsided and the sunless sky of Warp Nexus K-45 took shape in the view screen.
"Just one more transit and we'll be in Erebor. And Admiral Villiers knows we're coming, so he must have gotten the colony set up for rapid evacuation. This time there'll be no civilians left behind."
"Not on my watch," he didn't add. "No, sir," echoed Captain Yu. Most of the flag captain's attention was on the tactical display, as one after another of Task Group 58.1's super dreadnought-sized flower-class transports and dull-knife-class assault transports emerged with their six escorting light cruisers. The task group had been hastily assembled with the single objective of getting Erebor's colonists out of harm's way, for that system's puzzling reprieve couldn't last forever. You couldn't help thinking about it.
"I wonder why whoever they are have delayed so long, sir. I mean, it's been almost a month."
"Who's to say, Wang? Maybe we're the first opponent they've ever met who's ahead of them technologically. From his report, Admiral Villiers must have given them a good shaking up before he had to evacuate Golan."
There was a silence at the mention of Golan. Yu broke in diffidently.
"Too bad about those civilians. What do you suppose—"
"Oh, I'm sure most of them are still all right."
Reichman's voice was just a shade too hearty.
"The enemy,
whoever in God's name the enemy is, will want to keep them alive for forced labor, and maybe for their hostage value. Only makes sense, doesn't it? He made a dismissive gesture. Anyway, we can't let ourselves worry about that now. Our job is to make sure the same thing doesn't happen in Erebor on a larger scale.
Yes, sir, you agreed. Believe me, I'm not complaining about the time the enemy's given us, and I imagine Admiral Villiers isn't either.
You can be sure of that. Warships and ammunition colliers, faster than Reichmann's lumbering transports, had already reached Erebor in the maximum numbers fleet had been able to scrape up.
He's been heavily reinforced, especially since Admiral Teller should have gotten there by now, and he's been replenished with antimatter warheads. So if the enemy still think they've got a monopoly on those, they're in for a rude awakening. And judging from that courier drone we passed in the Sarasota system,
Admiral Murakuma's task force should be on the way. Those pre-space denizens of Old Terra who bequeathed Rear Admiral Vanessa Murakuma her married surname would have been shocked to know they had, for she was unmistakably Gaijin.
Generations of the 0.78G gravitation and UV-poor sunlight of Truman's world had produced a fairness of skin that was rare indeed among Old Terra's grandchildren after so many centuries of racial blending. Her green eyes and the slenderness that made her seem taller than her 168 centimeters mingled with waist-length, flame-red hair to give her the look of one of the ancient Said from the misty island whence Truman's world's original settlers had come. She also seemed too young to be an admiral, but that was an illusion conferred by the anti-Gerone treatments the Federation supplied to its colonists. In odd contrast to the strong chin that redeemed her face from delicacy, she had dimples, which appeared to her annoyance in moments of amusement. They were not in evidence now.
"Did you get in my last addendum to the report, Leroy?"
She paused in her pacing to glance again at the blip that represented the receding courier drone.
"Affirmative, sir. I double-checked with communications."
Captain Leroy McKenna, her chief of staff, wondered why the admiral was so antsy about her urgent request that Marcus LeBlanc be assigned to her staff. Of course, there was the rumor that she and the intelligence community's slightly aging enfant terrible had once, but even the juiciest versions of that rumor agreed that it had been a long time ago. Surely it couldn't be the reason. The admiral seemed to read his thoughts in that disquieting way she had, for her lips curved in a smile too slight to conjure even the ghost of a dimple.
"I need his insights, Leroy. He's the only one who's done any thinking lately on the subject of unprecedented alien threats. However little some people—of course she couldn't name names, least of all that of Admiral Anthony Villiers—think of his speculations, or the way he went public with them."
McKenna grinned.
"Don't worry, sir. There was plenty of time to amend the report before we fired it off."
She acknowledged with a distracted smile and resumed her pacing. TFNS Cobra's flag bridge was maintained at the TFN's statutory one-standard Terran G.
But Murakuma, for all her light-world upbringing, paced with a determined stride for which the flag bridge seemed too confining.
She was thinking of the unknowable that lay ahead, and of the courier drones that had already proceeded up the communications chain, and how far their reverberations must have reached by now. Indeed, they must have reached Old Terra itself by now.
"But surely the fleet could have tried to communicate with them. After all, anyone who can build spaceships must be rational, and all rational beings must want peace."
Sky Marshal Hannah Avram thought beautiful thoughts and tried to tune the whiny voice out. She didn't even waste the mental effort it would have required to wonder if the Honorable Legislative Assemblywoman had forgotten the genocidal Rigelians and the fanatical Thebans, both of which races had been all too capable of building spaceships, and neither of which had subscribed to the philosophy the Honorable Legislative Assemblywoman, with a parochialism fit to shame a medieval peasant, assumed must be universal. She had long ago given up hoping for anything better from Bettina Wister of Nova Terra and the rest of her mush-minded ilk. It wasn't that they were incapable of rational thought. Wister, for example, was a past mistress at servicing her constituents and managing the bureaucratic political machine, which assured her continual re-election to the Legislative Assembly. They were simply too lazy, ignorant and self-absorbed to look beyond their own rice bowls, and attempting to hold them to a higher standard was pointless. Better to just let this Naval Oversight Committee meeting meander to its conclusion and try to catch up on her sleep. But the nasal platitudes wouldn't go away.